The headlines this hour. China and Russia blast NATO over its position against Beijing and Moscow at the alliance summit in Madrid. NATO says it is ready to help Ukraine obtain a wide range of modern military equipment, urging Russia to withdraw its forces from the country. Plus, Iran's foreign minister says an agreement is possible over the revival of the 2015 deal should the United States adopt a realistic approach.
Well, welcome to the studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us.
China censors NATO over what it calls a completely futile warning in which the Western military alliance declared that Beijing's power poses a strategic challenge.
NATO's so-called strategy concept document disregards the facts, gives a false account of the true facts, wrongly defines China as posing a strategic challenge, and smears China's foreign policy. It opposes China's normal military development and national defense policy, is irresponsible, encourages conflict, and is full of Cold War thinking and ideological prejudice. China is seriously concerned and firmly opposed to this.
Beijing warned NATO against hyping up the quote China threat, calling on its leaders to abandon the outdated concept. NATO leaders held a two-day summit in Madrid, where they put China in the crosshairs. They said Beijing's ambitions, policies, and close ties with Russia threaten NATO. Meanwhile, in Moscow, President Putin has said that there would be no problem if Finland and Sweden joined NATO. The Russian president's remarks followed an announcement by NATO that it would welcome such a membership. Putin, however, said that Russia would respond if Finland and Sweden become a ground for the deployment of NATO troops. The president said that it was inevitable that Moscow's relations with Helsinki and Stockholm would sour after receiving NATO membership. NATO says that it is ready to help Ukraine obtain a wide range of modern military equipment, urging Russia to withdraw its forces from the country. The NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said that Russia's war against Ukraine was, quote, brutal and absolutely unacceptable. He said that Sweden and Finland will sign on Tuesday the NATO accession protocol to formally join the alliance. The comments came 2 days after NATO member Turkey lifted its veto over the accession. The U.S. has announced another massive weapons package for Ukraine on the final day of the NATO summit in Madrid. President Joe Biden unveiled the new package worth $800 million. He said that it includes air defense and artillery, among other supplies. Biden said that Ukraine should receive the goods in the coming days. This is the latest in a series of Western arms shipments to Kiev. On Monday, Washington announced that it would send sophisticated anti-aircraft missiles to Ukraine. According to officials, the U.S. aid to Ukraine since February has been over $6 billion. Moscow blames the West for prolonging the conflict by sending more weapons to Kiev.
Leaders of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization gathered for their annual summit in the Spanish capital, Madrid. As expected, this year's summit turned into an anti-Russia agenda in the wake of growing tensions between Moscow and the West over the Ukraine war that began in February.
President Putin's war against Ukraine has shattered peace in Europe and has created the biggest security crisis in Europe since the Second World War.
The Western Military Alliance also pledged to ramp up military support for Ukraine.
And today, leaders agreed to strengthen our support by agreeing a comprehensive assistance package for Ukraine. This includes equipment to counter mines and chemical and biological threats, and hundreds of portable anti-drone systems.
Western countries, including the United States, have provided Kiev with billions of dollars worth of weapons since the war began. Russia sees it as the main factor behind prolonging the conflict.
It seems to us that the kind of line that the West has taken is absolutely counterproductive and harmful. The more they pump weapons into Ukraine, the longer this conflict will last.
Irrespective of huge military support for Ukraine, NATO's ambitious plan for expanding its membership has also driven a wedge between the alliance and Russia. However, NATO leaders have welcomed Finland and Sweden into the alliance after Turkey struck a deal with the Nordic duo to drop its objections.
Today, NATO leaders took the historic decision to invite Finland and Sweden to become members of NATO. The agreement concluded last night by Turkey, Finland and Sweden paved the way for this decision.
Russia says the two countries' accession to NATO is destabilizing.
We consider the expansion of the North Atlantic Alliance to be a purely destabilizing factor in international affairs. It does not add security either to those who are expanding it, those joining it, or to other countries that perceive the alliance as a threat.
The rift between Russia and the West has raised concerns that the ongoing war in Ukraine could escalate into a nuclear conflict, the fallout of which could deal devastating blows to the world.
From Donetsk, correspondent Johnny Miller talks about how NATO and Western policymakers are pushing Ukraine towards a prolonged war with Russia.
I don't think NATO has any regard whatsoever about the Ukrainian soldiers dying in this war. They are completely outmatched by the Russian army. I have no doubt, for example, if it was a British army there who was outmatched on the battlefield, NATO would withdraw that army. But they're not doing that for NATO, for Ukraine. They're pushing Ukrainians to continue to fight. And many analysts have said some time ago, increasingly say now, that Ukraine can't win this war. Russia is systematically destroying the Ukrainian army. And more Ukrainians are being called up to fight. So it's civilians who are dying, Ukrainian soldiers particularly are dying. Of course, we don't know the Russian figures, but they are dying as well. And it seems, as you rightly say, that NATO is just pushing for continued war. The most recent statement coming out of America, there's a different statement almost every day, but the most recent statement is that they think that Russia is trying to take over most of Ukraine. And if that's their policy, then that means their policy is to continue the fight, because Russia would be very open to negotiating a peaceful end to this conflict based around giving up some territory in the south and in the east. And for the United States to suggest that Russia wants to take the whole of Ukraine or most of Ukraine, they're essentially saying that we want Ukraine to continue to fight. And of course, NATO doesn't really have the interests of Ukrainian soldiers or the well-being of Ukrainian cities at heart. It's not going to affect their politicians at the ballot box. They can continue to fight Russia to the forlorn hope of damaging Russian power, of trying to damage the Russian army.
Russian forces have pulled out of Ukraine's Snake Island in the Black Sea, citing humanitarian reasons for the move. Russia's defense ministry says the withdrawal was a gesture of goodwill. Moscow says the troops have been done with their tasks in the region. The Kremlin says Russia is not seeking to impede efforts by the UN to open a humanitarian export corridor for Ukraine. In Kyiv, however, the government has a different narrative. It says it was Ukrainian forces who drove the Russian troops out after a massive overnight assault. Kyiv has hailed, quote, foreign countries for their military assistance. Russia captured the strategic outpost on the first day of its offensive in Ukraine in late February. Kyiv and its Western allies say that Moscow is blockading Ukrainian ports to prevent exports of grain. Russia dismisses that accusation. In Afghanistan, several explosions and heavy gunfire have been reported near the venue of the Afghan Jirga, or the Assembly of Ulema, in the capital Kabul. We were joined earlier by our Kabul-based correspondent Abdullah Amirzada, who filled us in on what is known about the incident.
Several explosions were heard and heavy gunfire. We do not know about the number of casualties, but Zabihullah Mujahid, the spokesman of the IAEA, has announced that he would have a press conference today in the following hours. Yesterday, actually, there was preparation for this grand meeting. The roads were closed, and the number of security soldiers and the protocols were increased very much. But today this happened, these explosions and barrage of fire. We do not actually know many things about that yet, because Taliban officials have not announced any details on this.
The Iranian foreign minister says an agreement is possible over the revival of the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA if the United States takes a realistic approach. Hossein Amir Abdollahian says Iran is resolved to reach a good, strong, and lasting agreement. He made the remarks in a phone call with his Qatari counterpart, Sheikh Mohammed bin Abdul Rahman Al Thani. Amir Abdollahian said that Iran has always taken part in the JCPOA revival negotiations with initiatives aimed at reaching an acceptable agreement. Al-Thani, whose country hosted indirect talks between Iran and the U.S. over the removal of anti-Iran sanctions earlier this week, described the talks as constructive and positive. He said that Qatar is ready to host further talks until a desirable agreement is reached and that all parties return to their commitments under the 2015 deal. The accord was left in tatters after Washington unilaterally quit it in 2018 and reinstated sanctions against Iran. Iran has marked the National Day of Fight Against Chemical and Biological Weapons. The occasion is to commemorate the victims of the Sardasht chemical attacks launched by former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein in June 1987. Saman Kujuri has more.
The Iranian city of Sardasht in West Azerbaijan province is the third city after Japan's Hiroshima and Nagasaki, which became the target of weapons of mass destruction in the world. In June 1987, Iraqi warplanes dropped mustard gas bombs on Sardasht in two separate bombing runs on four residential areas. The gas attacks occurred during the Iraqi-imposed war on Iran, when Iraq frequently used chemical weapons against Iranian civilians and soldiers. According to official reports, out of 12,000 inhabitants of Sardasht, over 8,000 were chemically wounded, while 130 people died of the mustard gas attack.
After 3 decades, the city of Sardasht is still reeling from the consequences of Iraq's chemical bombardment, since many of the survivors still have to live with the long-term respiratory and even psychological effects of inhaling mustard gas used in the attack.
In April 2004, the Tehran Public Court found the government of the United States liable for the attacks through its support for the regime of Saddam Hussein. The U.S. government was ordered to pay $600 million in compensation to the victims.
The chemical attack survivors fell victim to some Western government's inhumane policies when Western companies gave Saddam's regime chemical materials and technology for production of chemical weapons, with the representatives of their government in the UN Security Council remaining silent, turning a blind eye to Saddam's chemical crimes and letting him continue using chemical weapons against combatants and civilians. The U.S. and its allies are the main perpetrator of this heinous crime.
Saddam's regime used chemical weapons against Iranian forces and civilians more than 300 times during the 8-year war, leading to the injury of more than 100,000 people, including thousands of civilians. Over 400 Western companies equipped Saddam with chemical and biological weapons. According to available documents, most of these companies belong to Germany, Britain, and France.
Despite the passage of 35 years from the Sardasht chemical bombings, still the families of victims urged the international community to bring the main perpetrators of the crimes to justice. But their call seemed to have fallen on deaf ears so far. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
On to Syria. An Iranian firm has rehabilitated part of the Aleppo power plant, a step towards reviving Syria's industrial hub whose electricity grid was destroyed during the years-long conflict. Iran's Mapna Group has repaired the fifth unit of the plant, bringing over 200 megawatts back to Aleppo's power grid. The first unit will also be ready for operation soon. The station, which has five units, produced over 1.1 thousand megawatts before the Syria conflict. It is one of the biggest plants in the country. The Iranian firm started the project in 2017, after Iran and Syria signed a memorandum of understanding to restore electrical infrastructure in the Arab country. The plant was reportedly hit by the U.S. warplanes a few years ago and went out of service. Israeli lawmakers have voted on the dissolution of the Knesset, a development that marks the end of Naftali Bennett's tenure as prime minister. The dispersal of the parliament will fuel continued political instability in Israel, pushing the regime towards its fifth election in just over 3 years. The lawmakers have also voted to hold the elections on November the 1st. Last week, Bennett moved to dissolve the Knesset after his ruling coalition collapsed following a series of defections. The Prime Minister says that he will not run in the upcoming election. His predecessor, Benjamin Netanyahu, has called Bennett's administration the worst in Israel's history. Netanyahu is planning a comeback by winning a sixth term in office, even though he's on trial for a number of corruption charges. In Sudan, four more protesters have been killed by security forces after thousands of people took to the streets to call for an end to military rule. Medical sources with the protest movement say that the deaths bring the toll from months of protest-related violence to 107. Media reports say security forces fired tear gas and stun grenades to disperse the demonstrators. Over the past 8 months, the protesters have demanded the reversal of an October military coup led by Army Chief Abdel Fattah al-Burhan. The coup in 2021 toppled a mixed civilian-military transitional government that was formed following a 2019 coup, ousting Omar al-Bashir. The latest protests marked the third anniversary of the huge demonstrations that overthrew Bashir. And with an update on that news, death toll at this point has risen to 5. Tens of thousands are out protesting against the military rule in Sudan, so the death toll now has increased to 5 there in Sudan. Italy's economy is facing multiple threats. The gas squeeze, higher interest rates, and plummeting consumer confidence are threatening to bring down the country's economy on multiple fronts. Max Civilli has more from Rome.
A perfect storm is brewing for Italy's economy, just as the country was beginning to see the light at the end of the tunnel after getting badly hurt during the pandemic. A combination of more unexpected shocks is threatening its stability. The energy crunch due to the Ukraine crisis, the subsequent energy price spikes and rising interest rates are threatening to put Italy's economy on the ropes.
Confidence has diminished considerably in Italy, with consumers and companies seeing a less positive future. Households are increasingly feeling the brunt of the inflation that has risen to nearly 7%, the highest level in over two decades.
Analysts are saying that Italy's economy could contract further if Russia, after reducing gas supply by 40%, decides to stop the flow of gas altogether. A total halt in supply could trigger company shutdowns and layoffs. Numerous protests have been staged across the country over the past weeks amidst growing skepticism toward the government. As the European Central Bank is expected to adopt higher interest rates to counter the Eurozone's growing inflation, conditions of living are expected to worsen in Italy and across the old continent. Many fear this deteriorating scenario is likely to lead to a hot autumn of protests. Max Civilli, Rome.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
in the limelight. More than two-thirds of American women disapprove of the U.S. Supreme Court's decision to overturn the landmark abortion rights case Roe v. Wade, a new opinion poll has found. The article you're about to hear has been written by Newsweek journalist Xander Landon. The article has been published by Newsweek and is titled Supreme Court Overturning Roe Met with 67% Disapproval Among Women. On Friday, 24th of June, the court released the opinion in Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization, which ended a woman's constitutionally protected right to an abortion at the federal level and leaves it up to the states to implement their own abortion policies. Some U.S. states are immediately moving to impose trigger laws to ban the procedure, while some experts estimate that without Roe v. Wade, abortion is likely to become illegal in about half of the country. The opinion poll conducted by CBS News YouGov surveyed 1,591 people on Friday and Saturday after the court released its opinion that overturned the 1973 landmark decision. 59% of those surveyed said they disapproved of the decision to overturn the Roe v. Wade ruling, while 41% said they approved. Meanwhile, 67% of American women and 51% of men said they disapproved of overturning Roe v. Wade. On the other hand, 49% of men approved of the court's actions, while only 33% of women did. The survey's breakdown fell largely along party lines, with 83% of Democrats saying they disapproved of the Supreme Court's actions, while 78% of Republicans said they approved. The opinion poll also asked respondents whether or not they believe abortion should be legal in their state. 64% said they believe abortion should be legal in all or most cases, while 36% said it should be illegal in all or most cases. While 31% of those surveyed said they believed the decision was a step forward for America, 52% said it represented a step backward for America. Only 17% said it represented neither. An opinion poll conducted by Yahoo News and YouGov in May, more than a month before the Supreme Court's ultimate decision was finalized, found that only 31% of Americans supported overturning Roe v. Wade. In the wake of the court's actions on Friday, 24th of June, conservatives celebrated the decision, while Democrats blasted it. On Friday, after the news about the overturn was announced, President Joe Biden said it was a very solemn moment for the United States. The Supreme Court expressly took away a constitutional right from the American people that it had already recognized. They simply took it away. That's never been done to a right that is so important to so many Americans, Biden said. CBS News said the margin of error for its opinion poll was 3%. Meanwhile, Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez suggested on Sunday, 26th of June, that Supreme Court justices should face impeachment if they lied about their stance on Roe v. Wade during their confirmation hearings. After the Supreme Court overturned the landmark case that guaranteed American women the right to an abortion, attention turned to the conservative justices' remarks during their confirmation hearings, as many of them suggested they believed the case to be settled by law, only to go on to rule it unconstitutional. During their confirmation hearings, Chief Justices Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh called the case an important precedent, which led some senators to believe they would uphold the case and voted them through. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, a New York Democrat, accused the justices of lying under oath, warning that not impeaching them would send a blaring signal to future Supreme Court nominees that they can lie to secure their confirmation during an appearance on NBC News' Meet the Press program.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Hidden Files. Have you heard about the billionaire space race? What about Harvey Weinstein's abuse case? Or the Trump supporters' takeover of the U.S. Capitol? Well, chances are that you have. When it comes to major stories from mainstream media, the world is certainly a small place where the news is heard loud and clear. But in the cacophony of these major stories, there are many voices that are hushed. Stories that seem as small as a single ordinary person and yet are as large as a community, a major city, or even a nation. We'll be right back. Hello, and welcome to Hidden Files. I'm Marzieh Hashimi, and today, in this new program, I'd like to take a pledge to provide you with a rare glimpse of news that seldom make the news, or stories that don't fit the mainstream plot, and of voices that are silent. But before we go further, let me tell you a personal story that doesn't only belong to me, one in which, had things gone differently, I would likely not be here with you today, and neither, perhaps, with the idea of this program, a story that started some 3 years ago with my arrest in the U.S.
It's just past 7:30 in the morning over here in the Iranian capital. You're going to have to begin this bulletin with a shocking development. Press TV's news anchor, Marzieh Hashimi, has been detained and imprisoned in the United States with no formal charges. Ms. Hashimi was arrested in a St. Louis airport and has now been transferred to a Washington, D.C. facility by the FBI. The reason for her arrest, as I just said, remains unclear up to this moment. She was visiting the United States to visit her ill brother, who was terminally ill, I've been hearing, and of course visiting her other relatives. Ms. Hashimi has informed her family members of her ill treatment in detention. Hashimi, a Muslim woman, was born in the United States and is an American citizen.
Such stories of being kidnapped and arrested without charge are so surreal that it's hard to believe that it can happen to you. Until, of course, it does. Growing up as a Black American, studying journalism as a student and later as a convert to Islam, I heard and read this happen to many others, of course, but I never thought that I myself could end up being kidnapped and arrested. And that's exactly the point. The numbers speak for themselves.
Mass incarceration in the United States definitely has a racial component to it. According to the United States Sentencing Commission, Black male offenders receive sentences on average 19.1% longer than similarly situated white male offenders. In addition, Black men are 6 times more likely to be incarcerated than white men. Following is the lifetime likelihood of imprisonment for U.S. residents born in 2001.
With me understanding well the history of policing and the judicial system in the United States, when I was arrested, I knew that anything could happen to me. I knew that there were political prisoners in the country who were still incarcerated after 40 years and had spent most of those years in solitary confinement. Though the United States denies having any political prisoners, I knew how people had been framed for so many offenses. Now, my case was quite unique in another aspect. That is, unlike the many Black men, Muslims, and activists, I had a decent following as a media personality here at Press TV. So the station kicked off an awesome information campaign about what was happening, and social media groups went into full gear getting the word out. I didn't know about all this from the inside of prison, of course, but I did see that my treatment was quickly improved, and then in a matter of days, I was released without charge. But I don't know of anyone else who has been this blessed. It's not uncommon for Black men, for Muslims, and for activists to spend years in prison, at times in solitary confinement, without there being a shred of honest evidence against them. Many end up pleading guilty as they are not told that they will not be released unless they plea bargain and spend some years in prison. So it's only fair for me to use this platform to speak about those whose cases haven't received this kind of public attention, like fellow Americans whose country claims to be the vanguard of protecting human rights around the world. when in actuality it often falls quite short of defending human rights, even according to its own constitution. Well, I'd like to bring in my special guest for this program. Welcome, Dr. Cynthia McKinney to Hidden Files.
Dr. Cynthia McKinney, as a member of the Democratic Party, Dr. McKinney served 6 terms in the U.S. House of Representatives starting from 1993. McKinney left the Democratic Party and ran in 2008 as the presidential candidate of the Green Party of the United States. She is a major critic of U.S. policy as it is related to Israel and was part of a Gaza relief boat to help to get basic supplies to the Palestinian people of Gaza. The boat was attacked by the Israeli Navy. McKinney introduced legislation to have the government release information about the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. She has also introduced legislation demanding the release of government information regarding the murder of Tupac Shakur.
Thanks so much for being with us. It's a pleasure having you. Well, I'd like to start off in looking at the situation. I mean, it was amazing what happened to me and the way it went down, Cynthia. And it appears what we're seeing is the erosion of the Constitution. Your thoughts about this and how exactly is this happening? What's going on?
Well, I think what has happened in the United States is that over the years we've had a gradual shifting in even the kind of governance system that exists inside the United States. So there was a time when the Constitution was the primary law of the land and people spoke about constitutionalism. The Bill of Rights was something that rolled off the tongues of everyone, and if a law or a particular behavior was unconstitutional, it was challenged. But gradually what happened is that we saw the erosion of not just, of constitutionalism and of the Bill of Rights itself. And so a situation like what happened to you, which is unconscionable in a country that prides itself on freedom and due process and justice. But now no one's rights are guaranteed. And so you've got people who went to the U.S. Capitol on January 6th, and they are in solitary confinement. Many of them have been in solitary confinement for months now. And the situation has changed. I believe what has happened is that there has been a coup against the U.S. Constitution. And the average, ordinary U.S. citizen doesn't realize that the constitutional protections that have been guaranteed for centuries really are no longer protecting the people of the United States. And the average, ordinary U.S. citizen doesn't realize that the constitutional protections that have been guaranteed for centuries really are no longer protecting the people of the United States.
Right. Well, you know, it's interesting what you said. I mean, your thoughts overall on the role of the mainstream media in misinforming people about that reality of constitutional law and the basic rights that Americans once had, but they no longer do.
We used to have media. Well, actually, there was a time when we had real media. And even though that media had its own sort of vested interest or special interest in and of itself, you could at least get half of the story from U.S. Media. It's Walter Cronkite, and that's the end of the story. Or you'd have the other fella on radio, and he'd say, and now the rest of the story. So there was always a way to dig a little bit deeper, and we had investigative journalists who were given the opportunity to hone their craft with the problems around governance. So you even had, say, for example, the Washington Post with Watergate. It was the Washington Post that broke the story.
Right.
Now the Washington Post covers up because it's been purchased indirectly by the CIA by way of Jeff Bezos and a $600 million contract for various things that Bezos was able to get by way of Amazon. So you've got a situation now where we don't even have alternative, we don't have responsible corporate media. We don't have alternative media because now the foundations have stepped in, and you've got George Soros who's pouring money into the Democratic Party, pouring money into alternative media. You've got already the other foundations, the Rockefeller Foundation and other foundations, pouring money into alternative media. So what used to be that, or what used to provide that critical analysis of what actually is happening in our political system and who is benefiting and who is losing, you don't have those questions even asked any longer. And so therefore, we've also had a situation where the courts in the United States have said that it's okay for the media to knowingly lie to its consuming audience. So now you've got legalized lying, you've got an end of investigative journalists, you've got the concentration of ownership of the media, both alternative and sort of corporate. And so now, basically, I think it was Mark Twain who said, even back then, he said that, you know, the more education you have, if you get your information from the regular media, then you're misinformed. Well, yeah, you're misinformed, and vast numbers of people in the United States are misinformed because they get their media from what they think are trusted sources, but they're no longer trusted.
What's your perspective on the internet being controlled and how that can affect people who are actually searching for the truth?
The shame of it all is that the internet itself and the research and development that gave us quote unquote social media was paid for by U.S. taxpayers. For these should be, as are the airwaves for that matter, should be public resources. But there's very little public in the public resources that have been privatized. Well, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. said we need a revolution of values. And I would agree with that, talking about the United States. I would just say that we need a revolution, and that would probably end it full stop. I would end it full stop. We need to do away with everything that we know because it took a turn. And the turn that it took has been to the detriment of the people. It has been to the detriment of truth. It has been to the detriment of justice. It has been to the detriment of peace. We haven't had peace since I was an adult. And now I'm entering my senior years. And we still don't have peace. And in large measure, it's because of the belligerent policies of the United States of America. So we need to build new institutions, and they can exist alongside the current ones, but eventually we've got to get rid of the current institutions that no longer work for the people and no longer represent what they are supposed to be.
Well, when we look at the situation, I mean, Cynthia, both of us are American and neither one of us are living in the United States because of various reasons now. But when we look at the situation, the increase of censorship and pressure as far as the taking away of being able to have freedom of speech, I mean, what's happening? Where are we going with this?
Unfortunately, and there are so many more who are laboring inside the United States in jobs that they don't like, jobs that don't respect them, jobs just in order to make ends meet. And they, you know, for example, you have, I guess I shouldn't name, but I have followed many of the professors who are inside the United States, and they've been punished because of their belief system. And one of them is a Palestinian American who had a job offered to him, and then the job was snatched away from him when he put something on Twitter, and it's a shame. We have another professor who wrote a very internationally acclaimed book. That book was about the Holocaust, and he told me, Cynthia, I haven't worked since then. And that's probably been about 10 years ago, 10 or maybe 15 years ago now. So people are being punished. People are suffering in their own ways because the diminution of rights and the Bill of Rights is not a document that is living and breathing in the United States any longer.
Where do you see all this going? I mean, what has to happen in your perspective?
Well, and people outside sort of look at you askance when you say, well, you know, I'm much more comfortable outside of the U.S. than I am inside the U.S. And people don't like outside because the United States is something, it's a dream. It's something to be aspired to live inside the United States. Every child's goal in life in certain countries is to be able to get a job in the United States, to be culled by the great culling machine and then leave one's country in the brain drain and go and help make private organizations like Google and Facebook more wealthy than they already are. The world has been turned upside down. Our values have been turned upside down, and the system is rigged, and it's rigged internationally as well. That's not just a inside the United States kind of thing. It's been rigged for hundreds of years. How do we unrig ourselves? I was at a anti-war protest, and I ended my speech by saying, "We shall take our country back." And then I thought about it for a while, and I said, I've been participating in anti-war speeches for 20 years, and we still haven't taken our country back, and we haven't ended the wars. After that last anti-war speech with the anti-war crowd that I was with, those are my people, and I thought about it, and I said, you know, I've been protesting for 20 years. I've been saying we're going to take for 20 years, and it hasn't happened yet. So what's the missing ingredient? When Trump said that the system is rigged, it was right. It was accurate. It was an accurate statement of that people in the U.S. find with their governance system now. What was left out of that analysis, though, was what has happened to the people since. I believe that for hundreds of years, as the system was being rigged, the people of the United States adjusted to the rigging of the system, and so they adjusted themselves. They themselves became rigged along with the rigged system. The only way we can actually have values that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. talked about is that we've got to unrig ourselves. We've got to dig deeply within ourselves and understand who we are, where we are, what our country has lost, and how we can get it back. Finally, the other thing is that not only in this sort of rigging and unrigging, the United States has never dealt with some issues like the race issue. And race is easily used. It's the kindling that is always there, that all one has to do is throw a match that has been, but it still has a little spark. And that spark is enough to just combust the entirety of the United States. That is something that has to stop. And if it doesn't stop, we will never unrig ourselves, and we will never have the revolution of values that we need, and we will never take our country back.
Well, Dr. Cynthia McKinney, thank you so much for being with me. It has been a pleasure speaking to you here, Hidden Files.
the way the alternative media led this fight for my freedom and the way that on social media, hashtag Free Marzia Hashemi went viral were very effective campaigns and say a lot about the potential for alternative voices to play a bigger role in highlighting what is really taking place on the ground globally. Well, let's take a look at some of the actions held around the world during the Free Marzia Hashemi campaign.
Free, free Marzia!
Free, free Marzia!
Free Marzia Hashemi!
Free Marzia Hashemi!
Free, free Marzia!
Free, free Marzia!
Marzia Hashemi should be free!
Marzia Hashemi should be free!
She's African American. She's a woman. She's a Muslim. She has a conscience. She is intelligent. She is a journalist, and she is exposing America's dirty laundry.
Whether it's Trayvon Martin, whether it's Eric Garner, whether it's the people being starved to death in Yemen, or people being bombed in Pakistan, or people being killed in Gaza, or people being killed in Libya, Marcier's concern for humanity is that we live in peace.
Just because it's legal doesn't mean it's moral. Just because it's legal doesn't mean it's right. Just because it's legal doesn't mean it's just.
Free, free Hashemi!
Free, free Hashemi!
Free, free Hashemi!
Free, free Hashemi!
Up in arms on the streets of Tehran, anger today over the detention of a prominent journalist. Marzia Hashemi is an anchor for Iran's English-language state broadcaster, Press TV, and she's American.
It's a mixed bag.
Christened Melanie Franklin, born in New Orleans to Protestant parents. And inspired by the 1979 Islamic Revolution, Hashemi converted to Islam and changed her name. Her colleagues are demanding her return. Hashemi's boss says she's been mistreated while in custody and has done no wrong.
This is not an acceptable reason to make Marzia as a political pawn in a political play, in a political war with Iran.
What my experience has shown me is that we can and must try to magnify the voice of the voiceless, and we can be effective. We have to dig into files that others don't want to touch, cases that have been ignored because it just wasn't in their interest to portray. And this program is a start. Here, together, we can inspect, inform, and ignite the change that needs to take place so that more stories can have a happy ending like mine, so that people like you and me can have a chance at living a life as a person and not be reduced to yet another statistic, another number. God willing, we will be back with another episode of Hidden Files next week with another story from another corner of this vast world of ours that has so much more going on than the titles from the mainstream media. Stay curious.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.